Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, CEOs, founders and clinicians who are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. I am a CEO and founder of a health tech company myself, as regular listeners will know, called PocDoc. PocDoc is actually helping put the show on, so thank you very much. PocDoc allows anyone with a smartphone or tablet to give themselves a quantitative blood test, starting with a 5-marker lipid panel and a full cardiovascular assessment. So we're rolling out across the country right now, so it's all very exciting. But thanks to PocDoc for supporting the show. In addition, as always, thank you to everyone for listening. If you're listening live on Health Tech on UK Health Radio, welcome. It's actually UK Health Radio's 10th birthday last week, so happy birthday to UK Health Radio. We love being on the network. Thank you very much. Also, thank you if you're listening on Spotify or Amazon or any of the other podcast platforms, or if you're watching us on YouTube. Thank you very much. Much appreciated. We would not be here without you. So today's show is focused on women's health, and we have Lina Chan on the show. So Lina Chan is the CEO and founder of Parla, P-A-R-L-A, which was actually recently acquired, or acquired this year anyway, by Holland & Barrett. Obviously, everyone pretty familiar with Holland & Barrett. They're on most high streets. Lina founded Parla to improve women's access to healthcare information after she suffered multiple pregnancy losses and difficulty conceiving. And Parla addresses both the physical and the mental needs of women during reproductive, relating to reproduction, birth, and all of the associated issues, across 80 different countries. So Lina, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me, Steve.
Good. Okay, so I think it's super interesting that we come back to this topic. I've said for a while that we wanted to get more women on the show, so it's great that we have you here. And I think that your story is really interesting, because it's probably pretty common to a lot of people listening, I suspect. And so I think what's also interesting about your background is that you started off as an investor, I think, both in the US and in Asia, I think, I'm not sure.
US and the UK.
US and the UK. And then you started your own business, but still within healthcare. So I think what would be super interesting is just to hear your, you know, if you could just tell us your story just to begin with, and then we can kind of get into more of the details. But why don't we start there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born and raised in Brazil, so Latin America, and I moved to the U.S. When I was 18 to pursue my university education there. Graduated, went to work for JP Morgan at the time, so I started in finance and started working, actually investing in Latin America. So I was part of the private equity team, kind of invested in the first tech bubble across Latin America. But that was, you know, it was kind of always had that personality of working very hard. I came from immigrant parents. So it was a lot about kind of, you know, you put effort into one thing and you try as much as possible to get that. So I did that for a number of years in New York, and then moved across the pond and worked here in the UK investing. Went back to business school, met my husband, and then moved back here to the UK. And it wasn't until we got married and I was 35 and I was like, okay, well, you know, I heard that 35, your fertility starts, you know, your clock starts ticking. Maybe we should kind of start having children. It never really occurred to me that fertility was going to be a difficult journey for us. Like, I came from a family of 4 siblings, my husband, you know, 1 of 3.
Right.
And it was probably the hardest experience that I've ever gone through. And that kind of mentality and personality that I had leading up to there of, you know, put effort into it, you get it, just didn't work. It doesn't work that way when it comes to our health and much less our reproductive health. So Our first pregnancy, we actually didn't struggle too much to conceive, but then I lost that first pregnancy quite late stage. After 6 months, I was, you know, showing I was quite big, and I had to give birth, knowing that the baby wasn't going to be alive when I gave birth. And it was the first time, literally the first time that I walked into the hospital, and I knew that something was wrong. It was the first time that I had learned about miscarriage and pregnancy loss and stillbirth. So, and, you know, I considered myself somebody who had, was well-educated, you know, was very much kind of like proactive on my health. But I think it just kind of really makes you aware that it's, you know, it's just something that we just don't talk about as much in our society. And once I was in it and I realized, oh my gosh, one in four pregnancies will end in loss. Like, it's actually a very common thing that women will go through.
Yeah.
And it's also something that it's a risk that increases with age. Mm-hmm. And if we look at kind of like the demographics and when women are starting to have children now, a lot of them are making the exact same decision that I made, right? So they're focusing on their careers, they're going to get their business degree, they're only starting to think about children after they're 35. So actually their chances of having loss is quite high. And that was exactly the case that happened to me. My subsequent pregnancy that then took a while to conceive, I lost again. And I lost kind of earlier. And it wasn't any easier. Having gone through it once didn't mean that the second time was any easier. And it really, really affected me emotionally, physically. And it was just very hard to navigate the whole thing. Like, you know, your support system, like you're trying to figure out what's the right support system. Because it's so taboo, often even doctors didn't quite know how to talk to you about it physically or emotionally, like what you were going through. My husband probably felt like it was even more taboo for him going through it. And after the
pregnancy, you mean taboo for him to talk about it?
With other, you know, finding other people who had gone through it like he had. So, you know, what was supposed to be a happy journey ended up being a struggle of almost 4 years for us. And coming out of that, you know, my husband is a tech entrepreneur, and we were just kind of really baffled that something that was so important to people, was so misunderstood. There was just such a gap in data and research for women and the impact that, all our gynecological health has and reproductive health has on us and our outcomes. That we thought, okay, we need to really kind of think about how to use technology to improve access, improve people's knowledge, and then through that also start closing the data gap for women's health. And that was how Parlo was born.
And at what point did you or he have any previous experience of doing health related businesses or companies, or, you know, like what was your sort of baseline? You said he was a tech entrepreneur, but I don't know if he'd ever done anything in health tech, or I don't know.
He hadn't done in health tech, but he had done in climate. So, you know, so definitely kind of like areas that requires a bit more education, a little bit more bets. So he had done in climate. I had done some investing in health, but primarily medical devices rather than necessarily digital health. But having gone through what we had gone through for 4 years, we really knew the user very well.
Yeah.
And I think where companies and products have evolved is that we've moved away from being kind of product pushers to putting the user at the center of design. And that was one of the things that we kind of really brought to the table together, was we really understood the user as we were building around it.
And what did or does What was the initial sort of use case that you were trying to build for when you started Parlo?
So for us, it was a lot about educating women and their partners about preconception health. So I think it was really kind of trying to move away from this conversation around fertility being so reactive and only really kind of tuning into your fertility once you're already experiencing a problem.
Yeah.
But really kind of getting people to think more proactively about the importance of the months leading or years even leading up to you trying to have children. So better knowledge of your cycle, better knowledge of your fertility, better knowledge of your sperm, So it was a lot around that. And it was a lot around also looking at a very holistic approach to health, because I think very often it's so easy to just compartmentalize things like, okay, this is the, you know, this is the medicine you're going to take, but then you completely ignore things like mental health, nutrition, movement, lifestyle, which when it comes to reproductive health is so interlinked, right? Like women's hormones and their cycles will dictate how they feel, how their calorie, the calorie needs, how they might move. So it's such a misunderstood or under researched area that we really wanted to kind of bring that holistic view and approach.
And was there like anything, what was what was the best available, nearest available service or information source, or, you know, what was the baseline, I guess?
Yeah, we were really trying to disrupt were the very expensive clinics, right? So you go down Harley Street, and there are some great women's health clinics, and you walk in there and there is a mental health coach, there's a nutritionist, there's an OBGYN, you can get your supplements, you can get your scan, etc. Like, but I mean, £5,000 later, you walk out the door, which is just completely inaccessible, or you're waiting for months and years under the NHS. But when the clock is ticking, that's kind of, you know, very precious time. Or sometimes, unfortunately, like, you know, if you are of a certain age, the NHS will be like, well, you know, your chances are so low that we're not even going to treat you. So that's what we really wanted to disrupt. We wanted to use technology to really bridge that gap. So make it as cheap as possible for people to get educated and find the products that could work for them, and then also get access to the experts that could help them.
And, you know, how did it go? I mean, how is it going? What's the journey been like so far?
Yeah, it's been a few roller coasters. So we launched right before the pandemic. So we had probably like, 9 months of normal life before the pandemic hit. And when we first launched, we had the opportunity for people to come. They could do initial assessments. They could have chats with nutritionists, doctors, and mental health coaches. And then the pandemic hit. And suddenly what we realized was, gosh, how do we make the experts that we work with just reach a lot more women than kind of the one-to-ones that we had? And we ended up funding a whole year worth of work through grants. So we got awarded grants from Innovate UK, the Wellcome Trust, on providing a digital first approach to women's health. Because so much of like the clinics had shut or had turned to primary care to really kind of tackle COVID. So we ended up launching our first cohort-based learning programs. And at the time, we had already been, you know, in the market for a year and a half. And we started to realize that even though we had kind of initially gone out with helping women improve knowledge around preconception health, we started to realize that actually women come to us with very specific needs. And we had certain pools of women that were coming to us. So women who were struggling with PCOS symptoms, women who were struggling with endometriosis symptoms, struggling with IVF or pregnancy loss. So we started to actually curate and get programs and signpost people to products within each one of these journeys. And also because it just became a lot more personalized. And that's kind of how we then evolved. So now women come to us with those very specific needs. And they work with experts as part of cohorts, because what we noticed is so much of women's health is very taboo. So the fact that you actually are in a group with other women going through the same thing as you is just as helpful, and you learn just as much than on one-to-one consultations, and it just creates a really great bond. So we have those programs, and now as part of Holland & Barrett, we also have products.
Okay, like supplements and vitamins and such.
Yeah, exactly. So we, you know, so like you mentioned earlier this year, we got acquired by Holland & Barrett. And, you know, Holland & Barrett has this brilliant goal, an amazing goal to reach 100 million lives by 2025 and make health and well-being a way of life for all these people. And women's health has always been a category that they've really wanted to focus on. And we sit in this division that's called Wellness Futures, which is really the kind of looking at where is health going. So what are, you know, where is the future of health? And there's a recognition that it's really important to be there for the entire journey of a woman's reproductive lifespan and provide the education, the service, and then also the products. So really kind of like having all of that wraparound service around the products. So when I met them, we brought that to the table. We brought the education, we brought the experts, we brought the services, and they had the products. So it felt like a really great marriage of propositions.
Yeah, I know Holland and Barrett are trying very hard to move into this wellness space. They're already in it, but really trying to own that kind of journey, if you like, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting because they've got like 800 or so locations across the UK plus the online. So I think they've got this fantastic reach to be able to actually, like you say, make a huge impact. So 100 million lives by 2025.
Yeah.
And it's so far, part of me finds it so funny that there's like, you know, that women's health has been so under funded, under addressed, that it has to be talked about like women's health, you know what I mean, in that sort of,
yeah,
you know, in like quotation marks, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's, yeah, like, it should just be health, shouldn't it?
Well, yeah, well, I mean, you know, I don't know, like I mean I know there are specific biological things about women that are different to men. I totally understand that without wishing to open up like a whole debate about gender, but that's a separate issue. But just conceptually, you know, but I just think it's a bit funny that it has to be always in like quotation marks, you know.
Yeah,
I think it's a bit of a shame, but we are where we are, I guess. And it's good that it's at least being looked at properly.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
And so, like, how was it? Well, I mean, I know from my perspective or my journey, you know, my wife and I, she was similar age to you when we started trying for children, and you know, she had a couple of miscarriages, and you know, to the point around the taboo nature of it, particularly, you know, I experienced it obviously as a husband. And it is really emotionally difficult to deal with. You know, it just really, really is.
Yeah.
And there isn't really any, I mean, I don't know. It's very hard to know where to go or what to do about it.
Yeah.
But it is extremely emotional.
Yeah.
Really traumatic.
And that's what we realized personally. But then when we were in the pandemic, we were working with the Wellcome Trust, and they had actually released this call, you know, kind of like a research call saying, you know, within the pandemic, were there certain taboo health areas that really was underserved during the pandemic? And we had actually identified miscarriages being one of the areas.
Right.
And we did a large research. We had more than 400 women respond to our research. And one of the biggest things was that mental health wasn't addressed within the NHS, and that they were just so left to figure out on their own, which is still the case. Yeah. And it's kind of crazy, right?
Yeah, I saw a news piece. Now you mention it, I can't remember. It was last week. Something to do with statutory leave associated with miscarriages. Did you see this?
Yeah. They've been trying to pass the bill for years now, because especially miscarriage, because, you know, after 12 weeks, or especially after 24 weeks, you do get some rights. But if it's before 12, you've gone through a pregnancy, but you get no rights. So a lot of women have to go straight back to work after something so traumatic.
Right. Which, I mean, yeah, hugely traumatic, both emotionally and physically. So how did you know, how is it going? Did it get passed? I don't know.
It did not. They didn't have the reading. So it's still, it's been a disappointment. Yeah. There more people are talking about it, though, which I think is, you know, helpful.
Right, it was on BBC News, which I'm pretty sure it hadn't been on BBC News before.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's interesting. I would like to get into more detail about it, because obviously, how do we start to change perceptions around this? And is that something that Parler wants to try and do, and that you want to try and do, which is create more of a discussion, an open discussion around this, this area, particularly with men, or is it sort of without men?
No, absolutely with men. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's not just pregnancy loss. I think you're starting to see more discussion around a lot of the different challenges that women go through. So PCOS, endometriosis has now become a really big area of focus, pregnancy loss, and menopause has had a really big area of focus. And that's where we want to play. We really want to be a voice of change across these different reproductive life stages.
Well, let's get into that, into the second part of the show. So we're going to stop for a commercial break right now. We'll be back in 2 minutes with Lisa Chan, the CEO and founder of Parler Health. We're back in 2 minutes.
The station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltz know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltz, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltz. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Hello, and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Lina Chan from Parla Health, which aims to deliver both the physical and mental support for women throughout their reproductive lives. So before the break, we were talking about the wider discussion, the normalization of the discussion around the different stages of women's reproductive health, whether that's preconception, conception, pregnancy, pregnancy loss, PCOS, endometriosis, menopause. That's quite a big set of things, right? That's quite a big, do you view them as a continuum or not like that? Or how do you start to get to grips with even how, yeah, I mean, that's a huge, you know,
it's interesting to say that, because I, you know, the way I see it is that we need to start engaging women as early as their first period. And mm-hmm. I think women's experiences across these different stages can actually have a knock-on effect on the future ones. So, for example, you know, we know that women who have PCOS have higher risk of infertility or miscarriage. And, you know, if you've had a very difficult fertility journey, you come out of that time very depleted. Does that then also have a knock-on effect on your menopause journey, right? So right. I actually think it's really very interwoven, our experience across these journeys. So I don't really see it as separate. I think it's actually really important that we help women start connecting these dots.
Because it's not necessarily like isolated, right? Like, for example, I know that we did a show, one of the early shows we did with the lady called Lisa Falkens from Femtech Insider.
Yeah.
And she founded a business focused on, her company was focused on PCOS because she was a sufferer of PCOS. So for those of you who don't know PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome, what are the statistics? Is it 1 in 10 women, 1 in 20? It's pretty high.
1 in 10, yeah. 1 in 10, yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. So 1 in 10 women suffer from it. And she threw out the statistic, which blew me away, that it takes on average 8 separate doctor's appointments before it's diagnosed, on average, yeah. Right? So that means that there's some people that are having significantly more. So it's often misdiagnosed as all kinds of different things because the symptoms can look individually like all kinds of different things.
Yeah. And the same thing with endometriosis. I mean, endometriosis also has the statistics of 1 in 10. It takes on average 10 to 13 years to diagnose. And the 1 in 10 is actually underestimated. And these are women who are suffering from extremely painful periods. You know, it's a whole body inflammatory condition. So not just painful periods, but it's, you know, it affects them so much. And, you know, we're in a society that in a way normalizes pain, especially right. for women, or, you know, you kind of get gaslit when you go tell your health professionals. And it's also a category that a lot of women who discover, actually, you know, often when women discover that they have endometriosis when they're struggling to conceive, and then they will actually be listened to and get further investigation. But
A lot of it comes, that the actual key diagnosis comes when they're trying to get pregnant, basically, because then it's at that point, it sort of becomes almost like a rule out thing. Yeah. It's like, right, okay, you've tried all these other things. Okay, well, maybe it's this. And then those other 15 different doctor's appointments have sort of led up to that moment. Yeah. So I guess it's around how do you try and cut through and get it diagnosed earlier or get it understood earlier or addressed earlier.
Yeah, exactly. And you imagine the mental health impact that it has on somebody, right? It's like if your pain is being ignored from when you were a teenager, or you know, you're struggling with
minimized sort of, you know, told to like you're making a fuss, or you know,
exactly. And that, and I think that's the root issue, and that's what it comes back to. You know, so little research has been done on the women physiology, or women has been included in research. So that's why it takes so long for these conditions to be diagnosed, and it really does have a detrimental physical and emotional impact. So for us, is that knowledge is teaching women that they, that you know, these symptoms are real, learning to advocate for themselves, until we can get the data and the medical system to catch up on those. Like, you need to really educate the patient how to advocate for themselves, because it is quite a bit, you know, it does take quite a bit of effort.
So that's a really interesting point, which I think is worth picking up on. So this is something that's, I guess, been given quite rightly a lot more coverage, I would say, over the last 5 to 10 years, which is that okay, I'm going to probably get this wrong because I'm not a doctor, but I'm going to say whatever. So apologies in advance. But a large percentage, most of it, of scientific clinical data is drug development or treatment development is been based on male research subjects.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Is that
correct? 100%. Yeah. Women has only been included in clinical trials since 1992. So
that's,
I mean,
nuts.
Yeah. So there's, you should read this book called The Invisible Woman. It's brilliant, but it just shows how systematically we've been left out of even to the level of the seatbelt. I think only I think it was only now that they actually started to do the seatbelt research based on the size of a woman's body.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's
bonkers. Yeah. It's crazy.
What?
And yeah,
that's completely nuts.
Yeah, just Google it. It's they did the first study this year only. I think it was it was the first one.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Okay.
So yeah, and the reason why women were left out of research often is because of our hormones. Because our hormones, you know, because in a research, you can imagine in a clinical trial, you need to keep as many things constant as possible. So you're testing just the variance of that one component that you're trialing, right? So once you add the women's hormones, it adds this level of variability that is very hard to control for. So it was always easier to not have the women and just have the male physiology. I mean, the COVID vaccine wasn't tested on women.
Is that right?
Yeah. So it's, you know, so it's
is that really true? It wasn't. And why was that? It just
I mean, probably for speed, they just needed to make sure that they could get it out. But you know, women, our physiology is different. Our hormones are different. So it has historically been easier to not include women, and only now women are starting to get included in research trials.
That's incredible. And so, yeah, I mean, when I heard that for the first time, which again I think was from doing the show. I mean, because again, it's sort of, you know, you don't know what you don't know, and it's not like I've been in drug discovery or, you know, clinical research or anything like that. But when I heard about it, I mean, the way that you explain it, I can sort of see why they came to that conclusion, you know. But similarly, like, common sense might suggest if half the people are giving these drugs to, you know, potentially are women. You even mean, for example, like chemotherapy drugs that targeted cervical cancer or breast cancer weren't originally tested. They must have been tested on women in some way.
I can't speak specifically to cancer treatments on breast, but I don't know those specifically.
No, it's just interesting. Yeah, that's what I mean, right? I'd be kind of interested to see how they would have tested a drug for cervical cancer on a guy. But so how, just to try and bring it back around into a bit of focus, again, does that change happen through lobbying, or is it just, you know, like including women in clinical trials just as a base, or even in, for goodness sake, seatbelt trials? I mean, unbelievable. Is that lobbying that's got that in there, or is it just generally people have looked at that and said that just doesn't make any sense, and they've kind of changed it themselves? You know what I mean? Like, how's that sort of, like, come about? I mean, the seatbelt thing is just bonkers, but anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to be a bit of everything, honestly. I think consumers have become more aware. I think the female consumer has changed a right. lot over time. So, you know, things like the Me Too movements, like all these movements that we've seen happen in the last 3 to 5 years where women has been given a bigger voice, I think is a really big positive step. I think the emergence of femtech, so having, yeah. even though so little of funding is given to women to enter femtech, I mean, it's still ridiculous that it's just 2%. You're starting to close those gaps because you're starting to have more female founders focused on areas that people weren't really talking about. And then you're also getting people who are lobbying more. And often, you know, I wouldn't say that no men do it, but I think often it is the experience. It's somebody who has gone through that lived experience, has gone through that issue and has that drive to say, okay, things need to change, that you then start hearing those voices and it becomes lobbying. But I think it really needs to be kind of a lot of organizations need to do it. The consumer lobby, you know, lobby institutions, but then companies also have a responsibility to close those gaps.
Yeah, totally. I think it's obvious. So on this issue of femtech, for those of you listening who aren't necessarily familiar with the kind of the venture space necessarily, we're a broad church, Lena. So we get, you know, we have all kinds of people listening. How would you describe femtech to people? Because there are different people think about it differently, which we can get into.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of explain it kind of more simply as there are businesses and technology businesses specifically that put the female user or the reproductive, you know, people who have a reproductive health at the core of their design. So it could range from tracking apps to people innovating like on the tampons, exactly, like Flow, Clue, to platforms that are delivering gynecological consultations, to even companies that are innovating on tampons. So you're looking at kind of the reproductive physiology or the reproductive lifespan and stages, and you're creating products and services to really help in that journey.
And like, just going to throw this out there. Do you think that any femtech business should be founded by a woman, or do you think there is a role from, or I have my own opinion on this, but what's your view on it given that definition?
I mean, given my experience in the last couple of years, it's helpful to have women in the team, or at least people who have that lived experience tackling the problem, because you bring a level of empathy and you bring a level of understanding to the design process of the, you know, kind of the product design process, which is very, very helpful. You know, I try not to be biased when I hire for my team, but you know, it's we pretty much have mostly hired people who have experience the conditions that we're tackling, you know, so right. women understand the pain points, right? And that's what you're trying to solve for is those pain points.
I think that makes it. I mean, I look, I'm a big believer in authenticity, right? Particularly when you're sort of starting out as a company, either it's the founding team or, you know, the initial management team or whatever, you have to have some element of authenticity. So I remember when we first started PuckDog, we were on an accelerator. So we're all about increasing access to diagnostic testing by allowing it to happen through the smartphone, focused on cardiovascular disease and so forth. But we were on one of these accelerators, health accelerators. There are lots of people on it. Well, a few people on it. And there was one that was a man, a male founder, sole founder, who was founding a business for a platform for women to support them with postpartum depression.
Yeah.
Massively laudable aim, obviously. But like, we were all a bit like, dude, like, do you not think that like you should get like at least like a woman co-founder? Not want to at least, you know, because, you know, I don't know if you've been on those acceleratory type things, we have to kind of pitch and kind of explain and ask questions and like, everyone's sort of looking kind of funnily about like, because you've got questions about the condition, you know what I mean? And like the questions I had to you about, well, you know, what's your journey and what's your story and how are you doing? And, you know, it's not like women have an exclusivity over that necessarily, but it makes it, you just have a barrier, you know? My advice to him was just find a female co-founder and then you're cool, right? And you know, everyone understands it takes a team to build a business.
Yeah.
But I just don't think you're gonna, how are you gonna understand even what to say or have any authenticity?
Well, and I think when it comes to health, there's an element of trust, right, that it's really important to build. And I think you build trust in two, not just these two ways, but I think two primary ways. And is one is making sure that it's scientifically backed. But then I think two is this lived experience. Like, that's why these community, like, you know, a lot of these like support communities can get so viral, right? So because you have like this, you know, that this person has gone through it, so they can really empathize. I couldn't agree more. I think authenticity, lived experience gives you a kind of empathy and credibility, definitely.
Yeah, not least with your customers, right? I mean, I think that, like, as you say, consumers are being more choosy about where they go, particularly with their health. So,
yeah.
You know, I just could see images of him being on stage and doing these presentations and stuff.
Oh, no,
you know,
did he manage to do some crap?
Femtech Insider or whatever it is, and, you know, women in tech, and then there's like women and then just him talking about women. Anyway,
yeah.
I thought it would be kind of a bit strange. So, so within the conditions that you deal with, PCOS, endometriosis and things like that, one of the ones that I want to come on to, we're going to have a final commercial break in a second, is menopause, which, again, sample of one, over the last, I would say, 18 months to 2 years, has sort of rocketed up the media/news/general discussion awareness, you know, table. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
Yeah, 100% agree. It has definitely kind of shot straight up. It definitely helps to have celebrities talk about it. I feel like a lot of the areas that do get attention, you know, celebrities have spoken about it.
Who are the celebrities that particularly?
Davina McCall.
Okay, yeah, that's a big one. If you get Davina, that's a big one.
Yeah, so she was very outspoken about menopause, and I think, you know, created really a really kind of great movement behind it. Holland and Barrett actually has been doing a lot in menopause. So they had two campaigns, one in 2018 called Menopause, and then they just launched one this year around Pause and Listen. You know, and they've trained something like 4,000 staff to talk about the menopause, so people can come to Holland and Barrett and get health and wellness advice and tips for, you know, when they're struggling with perimenopause and menopause symptoms. And I think it's great. It's wonderful that has happened. And I really hope that it happens for other parts of women's health. Because until, you know, I say this a lot at Holland Barrett, I think until we really normalize all these conversations about women's health, it's very hard for you to say that you've democratized care. And to your point, like, you know, I talk a lot about how we need to bring her health on the high street, because that's when you really democratize health, right? Like, people can access it anywhere. Like, they can access it when they walk into a retail store. It's like you're making it as accessible as possible. And over time, it'd be great to drop the "her" is just health on the high street, right? So
yeah, it's like if you're a woman, these are the services. If you're a man, these are the services.
Yeah, and it's just easy to access. You get educated. You tap in, and I'm sure that's kind of, you know, where your product is headed, is really kind of making that knowledge as easy for somebody to connect with, so that they can actually come out of the ill health and really be more in the well-being and proactive about their health. Right?
POCDOC particularly is sort of focused on within certain pathways, so cardiovascular health, type 2 diabetes, female hormone panel, actually, we're working on in early stage development, because there's huge friction. Anywhere that there's huge friction around access to testing, but there's huge value in knowing that particular quantitative level, and that there's a value/incentive/requirement to test regularly. So longitudinal data has value. And finally, that there's actually a really valid, rich downstream post-test pathway. So for example, in cardiovascular disease, it could be a statin prescription, healthy living, diet plan, weight loss, repeat testing. That's actually really quite rich behavior change.
Exactly.
Similarly, you know, with the female hormone panel, it would be around understanding your fertility, your cycles, how that might overlay with your fertility journey, your other reproductive health, your diet, your weight, these type of things.
Yeah. So,
and type 2 diabetes is similar to the cardiovascular pathway. So we're trying to facilitate that whole pathway by enabling someone to do lab grade tests, but using their smartphone, but having replicated the technology backbone of the lab. So everyone loves the lab technology backbone, right? So the sample goes in and it goes through the system and the results come out the other end.
Yeah. Right?
So in order to play in any of those spaces in a meaningful way, aligned with healthcare providers, you have to be able to replicate that, which is what we've done. And yes, it's about access. So where is there a problem with access? Where does access really, really help? Not just on a day-to-day basis, but particularly with health inequality.
Yeah. Right?
There's a key, I mean, you know, and I'm sure we can get into that as well, which is, I suspect that the problems that you're talking about become more exacerbated the further you go into communities where there's deprivation, where there's lack of access, where they're underserved,
100%.
You know, where they might be ethnic minorities or whatever it is. You know, so actually access and coming up with a way to work out how to get to those people and not expecting them to go to their local GP surgery where they can't even go anyway at the moment because there's such a huge backlog. So, you know, trying to assess those things in our part of the world is what we're really about.
Yeah, 100%. Couldn't agree more.
Cool. Well, look, we are going to stop for our final break and then we will be back with Lina Chan, who is the CEO of Parla Health, part of Holland & Barrett Group, for the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour. See you in 2 minutes.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Lina Chan. So Lina, let's talk about the menopause and how there's been such a big change. I think there's been a huge change in how that's perceived and the awareness around it and the discussion around it over the last 2 years. What have you seen from your perspective at Parla Health?
I've definitely seen a lot more conversation, a lot more awareness, so that women know what to look out for. I mean, the stories you hear of women being prescribed antidepressants or kind of, you know, thinking that something was so really, really wrong with them physically, emotionally, when it was the menopause. It's great to start seeing that education and people talking about it. So I think it goes back to the taboo busting, right? The more people talk about it, the more you share the symptoms, the more people realize that, okay, this is something. It's a life stage, it's not me going crazy. And then you can start getting the support that you need. And that's always the first step, right? Like once you know what it is, you can then start getting the support. And I think there's, you know, for me, it's really important. And it's definitely something that we kind of live by a lot in Parla, is really reframing how women interact with themselves and their bodies and the stages that they're going through. Like, I think historically there's been a lot of negative words or even negative ways in which we talk about ourselves and our bodies. And there's a lot of kind of dialogue around the menopause that categorizes it as a disease when really right. Menopause is a stage, right? Like it's a life stage.
It's not a disease. It's a disease that everybody gets. Does that count? It's like aging.
Exactly. And I think it's really, really important that we start shifting that dialogue. Totally. Yeah. I mean, because, you know, so I got diagnosed with the menopause. Like, it's a life stage that you're in.
Oh, shit. Oh, yeah. That's true.
So I think it's important that we shift that, we reframe, help women reframe that and kind of start looking at this midlife stage that of something that can be wonderful, that, you know, it's a brilliant time in your life. And whether you're on HRT or not, there are also a lot of other things that you can do from a nutrition lifestyle standpoint to have you have a great life.
There should, without question, be enough support to be able to understand what's happening to you and to make the best of it in whatever constellation that is determined, hormone, you know, pharmaceutical, non-pharmaceutical, whatever it happens to be, right? So is that, I mean, I don't, it doesn't sound like that's where we were, certainly.
Yeah.
That might be where we're going to.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. It's where I hope we go to, is really kind of realizing and kind of empowering women with that decision, say, okay, well, you know, HRT is for me or is not for me, but then at least having those resources to say, I do need it or I don't need it, having the right assessments, but then also having all the other products and services to work around and complement that, right? Because HRT doesn't work for everybody. And some people will want to at least be looking at a combination of HRT plus lifestyle changes. And some people just actually don't even want to go on the HRT. So what are then other things that you can do? And it's really, really important. It's such a, you know, because menopause has over 30 symptoms, it's very hard. It's very easy to get diagnosed with something else. You know, so like so often they, you know, women will be diagnosed with depression when actually they're going through a menopause phase. Right? And it's a phase. Yeah, exactly. So I think it's I'm starting to see more and more positive movements towards that, like kind of closing that knowledge gap and then enabling women to get the right access to the right support.
So we did a great show a few months back with the CEO of something called EMBR, E-M-B-R Labs.
Yes.
Which is it looks like a kind of an Apple Watch, but it's like a slab of ceramic and it sits on your wrist and it targets your thermoreceptors on your wrists. So they have it came out at MIT and it provides a certain kind of electrical actually stimulation to your thermoreceptors that alters your perception of hot and cold. So it was developed with hot flushes in mind. And off the back of that, the CEO came on, who was a woman, Liz. And the thing that we got into, which I thought was really interesting, was like the so what about the hot flushes? Because I think that, like, you know, the cliche of menopause is the hot flush, I would say.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. Yeah.
And that's the sort of, you know, cliche sort of vision of it. And by making it a cliche or by it becoming a cliche, it sort of like minimizes it a bit.
Yeah.
So we got into like the so what of it, like what is the value of having something that can help you thermoregulate and what is the downside of hot flushes? And she was explaining, which I thought was, you know, I think this is just a hugely valuable topic to talk about, is like the impact on women's work lives and home lives, whether it's depression or stress or, you know, feeling like they can't perform at the level that they used to and the lack of sympathy from an employer or whatever it might be, or even just them being hard on themselves because of what's happening in their body, actually has something, I can't remember the figure that she quoted, but some sort of huge amount of lost days or lost productivity in the workforce, as well as people being diagnosed with depression when they're not depressed necessarily, you know, and just this huge kind of downstream, like we said, downstream impact of something that is minimized by, you know, mainstream culture.
Well, and you know, and it's funny because you know, we've been doing a lot of research and we've done a lot of user study about the menopause, and really, you know, the menopause, even the term menopause, is really kind of like the last day, the day after 12 months of not having your period. But a woman can be in perimenopause, which are the years before your menopause, for a very long time.
Yeah, like 10 years almost, I think, at the outset.
Yeah, exactly. And some of the first symptoms of perimenopause are actually not the hot flushes. Like they tend to be actually the neurological, the kind of, you know, a lot of the symptoms that you would probably associate with poor sleep or being stressed out, but actually those are the beginnings of perimenopause. So I agree with you. Like, I think when we kind of say, or the kind of cliche of, oh, it needs to be a hot, you know, a hot flush.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you're kind of kind of women aren't realizing that there's like 31 other symptoms that they should be, or they can be tracking. And then it makes it so misunderstood
And what are the lifestyle changes? Obviously, like pharmaceutical intervention, HRT, hormone, you know, that's more problem. But what are the realistic lifestyle things that people can actually do that actually have an impact?
There are a number of them. So we actually group the symptoms into, you know, there are some that are more physical, there are some that are more neurological. And for each one of them, there are areas that can help more. Exercising is a really big one. Making sure that you increase muscle mass. So starting to actually do weight training is very much advised in menopause. Yeah. So like, you know, swap your running shoes for a couple of weights is advisable.
And why is that? Why does that help? Do you know? That's interesting.
So you do lose mass. Like you do lose.
Yeah. When you get older.
Yeah.
Do women lose it?
Because of the drop of certain hormones, it is harder. Yeah, so that's why you will have issues of osteoporosis and also like just harder to gain muscle. And if you do weight bearing exercises, it actually helps you with your bone health. So actually doing weight training is very good. So add the protein powder, the creatine, and do some weights. That will help. And there are a number of things that you can do from a diet standpoint, because you know, one of the big hormones that drop is estrogen, but then there are estrogen available in certain foods, like, you know, not at the same type and the levels that you would from an ovulation, but at least including some of those foods into your diet. So soy is one big one. And you know, supplements also do work a lot, but a lot of it is actually the foundations of what we probably see as a whole foods diet, right? So really making sure that you have enough protein, anti-inflammatory antioxidants, like your omega-3s and your antioxidants. And I think what's really, really important, and this is probably one that is probably a little harder for those who are going through perimenopause and menopause, is sleep, right? Like we know that sleep is just so fundamentally important for our health and well-being. And it is one of the areas that actually gets quite disrupted with the hormone shifts. But it is, you know, it is an area that we always recommend people to try to get some support on sleep.
And I think that that's super interesting. And I think that this type of discussion is something that hopefully will happen more. And, you know, I think that the more discussion, the more understanding about this, you know, the more value that there is, and the easier it'll be all around. Let's talk about how all of these things overlay through the lens of health inequality, which has become a little bit of a buzzword. Let's just be honest about it. But I think it fundamentally means that there's a disparity in terms of ability to access healthcare and also your likelihood of being healthier, dependent upon your level of socioeconomic status, your ethnicity, your physical location in the country. And it sort of gets lumped up in this concept of health inequality, which, you know, fair enough, has to be labeled somehow. But yeah, it kind of covers a lot of different things. How does this area of women's reproductive health overlay or underlay across this sort of concept of inequalities?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of data that shows that outcomes are worse for minorities and communities. And I think until we address that, we are not taking steps really towards really closing the care gap. So it really is important that every company that is working, that anybody who's working on healthcare really thinks about what are the best ways for us to reach access, you know, improve access to those communities. And, you know, part of it is people from different backgrounds have different cultural lenses. So to really being able to build a brand that can talk to them is very important, or being inclusive is very important. And I think also just recognizing that it is also a population that has had a history of not being heard, not being believed. So there is a little bit more nurturing that we do need to do, and more inclusion that we do need to do. Like, I mean, we hear so many stories of, you know, Black women going to the hospitals and not being believed the same way if they weren't of color. And those are kind of the you know, inherited biases that we really need to try to make sure we step away from, and you know, and really kind of keep it in the ethos of our brands that we need to bring those voices and design for those voices.
And I'm guessing, but I might be wrong, that the level of tabooness, if that's a phrase, might be different around different things in different communities. Is that fair?
100% fair. 100% fair. I think there are, you know, there are certain communities that, you know, certainly when it comes to pregnancy loss, you know, we've had cases where a woman's feelings or what she had gone through was minimized, or, you know, they were kind of just told, well, it's not a pregnancy. It's not. So yes, it is quite, it is difficult to navigate that, but it's not impossible. I think it probably just requires, it does require a broader level of educating and making sure, like you said, like I think, you know, the authenticity is bringing people, a diverse group of people to help with the product design, product messaging, right. Marketing, right. Makes those, you know, accessible. Like, you know, if you're going to be kind of running a women's health campaign and you just have white blonde people, it's going to be very hard to connect with certain communities. So having to just have that consciousness on including the voices is really important.
That makes sense. So in the last couple of minutes of the show, I normally try and cover, you know, it's tough out there a little bit at the moment, and, you know, particularly for sort of healthcare entrepreneurs or any entrepreneurs and things like that. So, like, having started a business, scaled a business in COVID, like, what are the kind of the few key lessons that you feel like is worth sharing with the, you know, wider community, so to speak?
Resilience.
Give us a pep talk. What was that?
Resilience, that's the number one. Make sure, I mean, I'd say if you're an entrepreneur, you haven't started a business, start something in, you know, that you're very, very passionate about, because I think probably more lemons get thrown at you. So really kind of that passion is what makes you stick through stuff. And I'd say, you know, be really resilient and be very optimistic, because you never know kind of how things will pan out. And I think having that optimism will always allow you to see opportunities where you wouldn't necessarily. So if you're going to be starting your business, do try to have that kind of, you know, mindset for sure.
And how do you kind of maintain that, you know, when times are tough? Is it about the mission and you can stay true to the mission? And, you know, how does that play out?
Mission and my sneakers.
Okay, what, the running, right?
Yeah, it's funny. My husband, when he sees me very frustrated, he brings my sneakers and he's like, look, I think it's time for you to go to the gym.
Dude, I'm exactly the same. My wife's like, could you just go and do some exercise, please?
Yeah.
Could you just go and exercise, and then let's talk about this, and then let's see how you feel about this issue.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's, you know, I'm very driven for the mission. I mean, it's what keeps me going, and it keeps me kind of thinking and iterating. But I think it's really important, especially as a founder, to take those moments of self-care. And it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, a huge vacation, but it's those moments, like 30 minutes.
That'd be nice,
or an hour. That'd be really nice. Yeah.
That'd be great. When do I get to do that?
I know. But yeah, moments to clear your head is important.
Good. All right. Well, look, Lena, we've come to the end of the show. Lena Chan, founder of Parler. Thank you so much. Expert on women's health. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And thank you to everyone for listening. And, you know, have a good and happy, merry lead up to Christmas.
Thank you so much. You too. Thank you very much for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everyone. I see you calling.